The name of our session today is Parenting the Christian Ministry, with an underline to the, and we'll go at it from there. Did he tell you that I've just been basket weaving, so I'm shifting gears here. How many people have not been to one of our sessions so far? Okay. We're not going to backtrack to everything we've done, but just to kind of lay a foundation for the premise from which we're operating, I think will be helpful. We have been talking now for several sessions about what are the implications of the idea of the family as a network of relationships, of basic relationships that really makes us who we are, with a real sense of the diversity of kinds of families that looks like today, and really in a sense always has, but we're especially more aware of that fact today. So in the sense that I'm talking about it, a single person, whether living in community, as several of the single people we've talked to have talked about, or living alone, as say my sister does, really develops, I think, in almost every case, a network of close relationships that are people that that person will depend on. So in this sense, there's a family-type relationship to how I live my day-to-day life. And that reality, that experience, that relationality of my faith is not just an experience, an authentic experience of the gospel, an authentic experience of a community of faith. It really, in a sense, is the experience of faith, that it's the foundational church, domestic church. It's where it all begins and is built on from there. And so we've looked at that now in a number of different dimensions. We talked about the stresses on trying to maintain that sense of community in the face of an individualistic society, in the face of a lot of pressures that pull us every which way. We've also talked about how the values that community of faith based on the gospel is going to be living are against the mainstream, are definitely at points values that say, maybe for you, but not for me, thanks. Or not for us, thanks, when we're talking about community. And we talked about the prayer and ritual that are the ways in which we express this shared faith are going to take a really tremendous diversity of forms, but really call us to, out of this basic insight, look again at the very daily, the very ordinary kinds of experiences in our lives and say, doesn't look very holy, but when I really look with eyes of faith, I can at least begin to see the holiness that's right before my very eyes. And the implications of that, which unfortunately didn't really break open as much as I would have hoped due to lack of time, are really considerable. Today, we want to consider what is the ministry that is involved with Christian parenting. Then Saturday, we're going to look at the issues around marriage, and we'll probably look at single parents today a bit. And one issue that I think we'll try and, just so you're looking ahead, we might also want to explore, if you're interested, on Saturday, would be the complementarity and the tensions between this domestic church and the local church. How do we complement and not compete with one another in that reality? But today, here's where our focus is Christian parenting. Okay? Now, in terms of calling parenting the Christian ministry, isn't that a little bit presumptuous? I'm not so sure it is. I'd like to shift over here for a minute. Let's remind ourselves for a moment of what kinds of ministry, at least some kinds of ministry that we have happening in our local churches. What are some of the kinds of ministries that, as you think about your local congregation or parish, that occur to you?
Adult and youth education. Young Families Group.
Oh, really? Great. Those are, in our experience at least, rather rare. That's great. Do you have a babysitting co-op as part of that by chance? That's something we did when our families were young.
Counseling services, full-time psychologist.
Great. Okay.
Family counseling, personal counseling.
Super.
Chemical counseling.
That's great. Tremendous.
Refugee family sponsorship.
Okay, so there's a ministry to refugees that's happening? Okay.
Preschool.
Okay, all the Christian education going on, it seems to me. Good Sunday school here, but you know what I mean.
Day school.
Uh-huh, education ministry, okay.
Daycare.
Daycare ministry.
We call it global outreach.
So it's
worldwide mission basis.
Okay, so it's a ministry that goes beyond just the local community.
We have a social ministry where we do lots of things. We collect towels and take them to the mission because they need them.
Okay, so it's pretty related here, it sounds like, but it has a little bit different form.
We have a Siemens Center which families participate in housing.
Would you say the first part again? I didn't.
Seaman. It's a center where we're on the coast.
Okay.
And so ships come in and they have a place for those servicemen or seamen to come.
Okay. So that would be sort of a specialized.
It's families. They oftentimes the whole family goes down.
Great. Super. Food
pantry.
Okay. That would be another one of the ways in which this might happen. There's some important and pretty obvious ministries that I think are list lacks yet.
Worship.
Worship. And music ministry, too.
Parenting.
Parenting. Hospital ministry. Okay. Visiting those in the hospital or shut-ins. Right? What else?
Nursing home, small group formation.
Small groups, okay. Nursing home, I would put here again. Okay, small groups. For various purposes, huh?
Renew.
Pardon?
Renew, to help the country.
Okay. And various kinds of renewal, which might involve small groups.
We're part of a what they call THE house, temporary health and emergency house, where families passing through the area can come and get food and spend the night.
Okay, yeah, and that could even be homeless folks and so on. I would see that real related here. We have youth ministry here.
Singles ministry, single parents and girls support group.
Okay. Singles and single parents, right? Mm-hmm. That would be a pretty good starting list, at least. Now, which of these kinds of ministries and others that we could think of, there's grief ministry and so on, there are a number of things we haven't yet mentioned, does not have a family dimension to it?
Well, it depends on how they're carried out.
Right. It does depend on how they're carried out as to whether that's evident in the way the ministry happens. But as far as the needs in that ministry, which would not have a family dimension?
It depends on where you are in your family building. I mean, I could go through each one of those and say, yeah, at some point we've been involved in that ministry.
Mm-hmm. Right. But, and, okay, and I'm not talking about so much on the ministering end as I am on those, the recipients of the ministry, I guess, for a minute, or the whole process of ministry. Okay, and again, we're talking about a pretty broad definition of family. Are there any that you can name that really don't have a family dimension to them. I think it would be tough to come up with one that doesn't in some way or other have a family dimension, because as we are the ministering one, or the one being ministered to, we're still in relationship. We're still back. I think I did this the first day, where there's me in the center, and there's all these people with whom I am in relationship, and they really make me who I am, and I them, and any one of those relationships having been changed, whether it's someone sick, someone going through a life transition, someone in physical or economic need, or whatever it is, there's a family dimension to what seems to me is going on.
We also have a senior citizens group.
Right, right, and there's a lot more that we really haven't mentioned. I mentioned the grief one. So we really, I want to make kind of 2 points here. We really need to be very aware and increasingly sensitized, it seems to me, to the ways in which we are not ministering to an individual. We are ministering to an individual who is part of a web of relationships. And if I'm stuck in the hospital for a couple of weeks, you better darn be sure that part of the concerns and the needs that are part of my whole holistic experience there is what's happening with my kids, my husband, what's happening at home, and that's part of what needs to be ministered to. So that's one of the points I want to make, is we need to be more aware of the relational aspect of this ministry. The second one is, it seems to me as well then, if we're talking about setting a tone within the family, that parenting, if each of these has a family dimension to it, parenting is going to be a key kind of ministry. The Christian ministry, hence our title today. And so we want to talk about that in a number of different ways today. And I'll ask Mitch to take over at this point.
I'd like to see how in touch you are with your English literature. Two of the most famous quotations in English literature go like this. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Anybody remember where that comes from? Right, Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. And the closing words of the same novel are, "It is a far, far better thing I do than I have ever done," and so on and so forth. As, what's his name, climbs the scaffold there. To give his life, Sidney Carton, for another man. But I've always felt like those words apply very, very well to what parents do. Parenting is the best of times and the worst of times. It is a season of light and a season of darkness. Contrary to the kind of rosy images that we're offered so often about what it means to be a parent, in the media, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the kind of really bleak image that we're offered very often, which says all parenting is a pain and nobody should do it. Remember about, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, the Dear Abby column, what's her name, Abby ran a survey, and she asked people to write in and let her know if they had it to do over again, would they be parents? Would they choose to have children? Anybody remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you remember what the results were?
Decided percentage chose no.
Yeah, most of the people responded that they would not. If they had it to do over again, they would not have children. And she was just absolutely fit to be tied in her response. And basically what she said was, well, for crying out loud, what would you do with your life then? You know? Well, you're going to sit around and eat chocolate sundaes all day, or you know. So I want to put a plug in the first place for the goodness of the vocation of parenthood. You know, it definitely is one of the most difficult life occupations we can embrace. But at the same time, it has more importance than just about anything else I can think of, in terms of its long-range implications. Can you think of anything else that has, you know, it's that old image of tossing a pebble into a pool of water. You know, every kid we raise is another pool, a pebble tossed into the pool of the world. You know, And we don't know what the long-range effects of that are going to be. But the effect, you know, it's both encouraging and depressing to think about, you know, because none of us does it perfectly. But nevertheless, to try to be a good parent is one of the best gifts we can give the world. You know, to send a good person, a basically good person, out into the world, to then in turn have an effect on countless other networks and social networks and countless other relationships. I can't think of anything better that we could do, in spite of all the frustrations that are involved. Try to remember that next time, you know, from the, you know, next time you're up at night. At 2 in the morning, the 2 a.m. feeding. You know, remember that, or when the teenager is about to drive you right out of your mind. Okay? There are a couple of quotations that I'd like to share with you. First one is, anybody ever read any of Mary Gordon's novels? One of her novels is entitled Men and Angels. And in that novel, at one point, Mary Gordon, in this story, she says of the main character, she looked at the clock. It was 2:30. Soon the children would be home. She waited for the sound of their arrival as if she were dressed for a party, listening for a taxi. No one had told her what it would be like, the way she loved her children. What a thing of the body it was, as physically rooted as sexual desire, but without its edge of danger. The urge to touch one's child, she often thought, was like and wasn't like the hunger that one felt to touch a lover. It lacked the suspense and greed of the component parts of insecurity and vanity that made so trying the beloved's near approach. Once the children were in the house, the air became more vivid and more heated. Every object in the house grew more alive. How I love you, she always wanted to say, and you can never know it. I would die for you without a thought. You have given to my life its sheerest, its profoundest pleasure. But she could never say that. Instead, she would say, how was school? Was lunch all right? Did you have your math test? You know, such an excellent description, I think, of a parent's experience. Here's another one from Carol Hauslander's, one of Carol Hauslander's books. Carol Hauslander was an English writer who died in the early 1950s. She says, I have seen the hands of a foster mother chapped and bleeding from being continually dipped in hard water in frosty weather, and have thought to myself that the stigmata are not, after all, reserved for a few rare mystics. Okay, everybody know what stigmata is? I know what time is it. Is that just a Catholic thing? Okay.
It has to do with some mystics having the wounds of Christ. And so what she's talking about is, this is our way to holiness. Yeah. This is the way.
Okay. There are so many directions we could go with this topic that it's hard to decide which one to choose. First of all, I think it's important to understand that we hear a lot today about the value of learning practical parenting skills. You know, every time you turn around, somebody, either a speaker or an article or just an inference somewhere, we're getting this message as parents that it's important to learn good discipline skills and good parent practical parenting skills, parent effectiveness training and the STEP program and all these different practical skills that we can learn. And the first thing I want to say about that is that I agree. It's important. We are not born good parents. And the problem is that most of us do not grow up in a wide enough social context to get any but a very narrow experience of parenting ourselves. You know, most of us have only our own family's experience, our own parents, our own experience of being parented ourselves. We've all had that experience of catching ourselves saying or doing exactly the thing that our mother or father would have done, and sometimes it's the one thing we swore we would never do to our own children or say to our own children, you know. But that's where that comes from. We've got these tapes, you know, that we picked up when we were being parented, and there they are. So it's important, I think, as a broadening experience to read a few books and attend a couple of workshops and so forth. And of course, they never change us completely, you know, but every now and then we're able to pick up a new idea, and that's helpful. Have you had that experience yourselves, you know, of being maybe a little bit better parent, just a little bit, you know, as a result of reading a new book or attending a workshop or something on parenting skills? Okay, that's good. But, okay, I was all that was working up to this, but, you know, I think that even more important than the practical skills is the awareness on our part as parents that what we are doing is of value. I'm coming back to my original point there. You know, where our esteem, our self-esteem is not supported by our culture as a general rule. We are not told constantly by our culture how important being a parent really is. And she isn't even trying. Much more fun to watch a baby, isn't it? So I guess I want to encourage you as parents to give yourselves a pat on the back. You know, no matter whether your kids are 35 or 5, you know, give yourselves a pat on the back. One of the things we never stop being is parents. Once you're a parent, that's it. You're a parent for the rest of your life, no matter how old your kids are. You know, there is never a total severing of those parent-child or parent-offspring relationships. And they go on being an important part of who we are. And there's no such thing as a point when we stop worrying about our kids. Am I right? You know, we go on worrying about our kids till the day we die, I think. Yes?
My children are much better parents than I am.
Oh,
I'm learning from them all the time, uh-huh. Yes.
That's great you're able to have that kind of perspective. I think a lot of grandparents have a little bit different, you know.
And my mother the same way. My mother never had any education to speak of, but to me she was the wisest parent I've ever known.
Well, that's great. It must be wonderful to have you for a grandmother for that kind of attitude.
It's fun.
Okay.
Can I chime in something here?
Yeah.
I think along with what Mitch has said about it's a really important role and it's undervalued in our society, it's also, you know, he was talking about parenting books and the things that you read. I think by far the most important thing that I've picked up from reading parenting books, it was in the STEP handbook, Systematic Training in Effective Parenting, which is out of Rudolf Dreiker's work, and talks about the courage to be imperfect. The fact that it's okay to try it and to know that I'm not going to do it perfectly. And if you're a perfectionist like I am, you need to hear that constantly, because at the end of the day, I wish I would have brought it's an old better half, or for better or for worse, rather, cartoon that shows this mother, you know, having finally hollered and yelled and gotten the kids to bed, sitting over a cup of coffee, kind of sighing, and then going in and looking in as the children are asleep, you know, and the light streaming in from the doorway, saying, you know, how come, you know, you deserve a better mother than I am, that sort of thing, you know, how come, you know, after all the yelling, you know, we still managed to be in relationship with one another. I think there's it really is the strongest experience for me of bringing me right up against my shortcomings and my faults. And it is, it's really hairy. Would you say what you said the other day about the saying about parenting, because not everybody would have heard it, about rage?
Oh, yesterday I said, I read an article not long ago where parenting was described as rage, 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 and joy. And I think that's, I just think that's a real good thumbnail explanation there. And what we have, what as a general rule, the rage is not acknowledged. You know, it happens all the time. You know, it's a quietly controlled, you know, rage that is rooted in love. You know?
If we didn't care so much, we wouldn't.
Yeah.
Is that your experience?
Don't you think it lessens as you get older?
I sure hope
for
so.
Me, for me, it has.
Oh, good.
And my yeah. baby is 19, but I got mm-hmm. smarter. I yeah. mean, I wish I could do it all over now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's a good
yeah,
answer.
I think the older we are when we start parenting, the better off we are probably, theoretically. Yes.
My experience as a single parent, being divorced about 13 years, and my second son is 19.
Uh-huh.
And I picked him up to take him with me, and I was going to get the other boy to go out to my mother's to honor my father who passed away for Father's Day. We're going to be part of the church service. And he'd just gotten home from a choir trip, and he hadn't found a job. I thought he had a job when he got home, and it was getting to be a few weeks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told him I was pretty surprised he wasn't working, and the work ethic was pretty strong with me. And his remark was, and it really made me stop and think, he said, "You make me feel about an inch tall." And he said, "I'm really having a lot of trouble right now." And I said, "Well, what is it, Eric?" And he says, "I'm just having trouble growing up." Mm-hmm. And it made me stop and think, and I explained to him that I was appreciative of the fact he could tell me that, and that I felt I accepted it, and I felt bad that I made him feel so small. And I said, "I wish I could have told my father."
Yeah.
Not criticizing my father, but he either said, "Grow up," or "Let's get going." Mm-hmm. Yeah. "Hurry up, let's get going." Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it was, I really felt wonderful that I could accept that. And of course, it came back to his mother. His mother said, "Well, how did you do with your dad?" And he said, "Well, 15 minutes into with him, I was crying." Mm-hmm. And so she jumped on me about that, and I could explain to her that it wasn't my intention, yeah. but it was that work ethic that he had, you know, I had helped him on the trip, and now it was time for him to make some money.
Yeah.
But he did find a job. He's been working about a week and a half and working hard.
Mm-hmm.
It took some time, but it was probably meant to be that he needed some time to get his feet on the ground after this big trip from school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a good example of something, a point that I want to make, and that is that something we often overlook, I think, is that our children are a source of revelation. That is to say, I think there's probably different ways we can understand that, but the point I want to make is that if we watch ourselves in relationship with our children, when we are at our best with our kids, that shows us something of what God is like. You know? When we do it right, you know, the love that we feel for our children, that Mary Gordon described so well there, is how God feels about us, if I can use that metaphor. You know, if we stop and think about that sometime, we tend to have this image of God that is very cold and distant sometimes, you know, and a very judgmental God who is sitting kind of a big policeman in the sky kind of thing. And really God is showing us what the divine mystery that we call God is all about in terms of our own experience. How can God be any less towards us than we are with our own children? You know, the Old Testament uses that image of, you know, even if a mother should abandon her child, I will never abandon you. You know, so it's that, the way, it's our feelings towards our children and then some. And that happens in lots of different ways. If we watch our experience with our kids, at the same time, just watching a child growing up, a small child, the sense of wonder and sensitivity to the mysteries of creation and so on. You know, it's almost God reminding us to, you know, stop being so uptight, you know, and see what a wonder we've been given in just being alive, and the gifts that we've been given in the creation. And that we don't need to be kind. And Jesus constantly in the Gospels is saying, don't worry, stop worrying. You know, quit being afraid all the time. You know, and a child is just totally trusting in us. And that's the example that Jesus uses when he says, if you become like a little child. You know, that distinction between being childish and childlike is an important one there. Okay?
There was a comment over here.
Oh, yeah. Somebody have a hand up?
Well, I was going to say, relative to your comment about having children that are older, I was 42 when I first became a father, and I thought that at that point that it was going to be easier. Because, you know, I had seen other kids, my brother's kids grow up, and I'd say, you know, I don't think I'd raise my children that way. I'd do this, reinforce what they've done and whatnot. But you also get old and crotchety, and sometimes you get set in your ways, and they do things that you probably shouldn't get rage over, but you do get rage over.
Sure.
So there's that part of it, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. My theory.
Yeah. Let's see. Two areas that that I think are to us as parents are the spiritual formation of our children and the sexual formation of our children. And I don't know which one is, as parents we tend to have more problems with or more hang-ups with or more things to overcome in terms of our own experience. Anybody ever heard the name Bonnie Dreeves? Bonnie was a wonderful lady who lived in Seattle and was involved in early childhood religious education for many years, died a few years ago. And she was one of the biggest helps, I think, to us in terms of beginning our children's spiritual formation when they were still her age, you know, and so on. The idea, and her ideas were so simple. She said things like, you know, when a little child is, you know, you're out taking a walk and a little child sees the little thing, an ant crawling along the sidewalk, you know, or a sunset, or a raindrop falling off of a leaf on a tree, or, you know, whatever it might be, and it's just totally, just blows the child's mind, you know, this stuff. And she said things like, be sensitive to that and make the religious connection for the child right away. Say, you know, what a wonderful God we must have to give us such a beautiful sunset. You know, or what a wonderful good God we must have to create such a teensy little ant that can crawl around down there, you know, and do all those wonderful things. And I think as Catholics, Kathy and I, we tend to have less support from our tradition. We did not grow up with a high comfort level when it came to verbalizing our faith. You know, and it may be that those of you who grew up in other traditions don't have as much of a problem with that as we did. I don't know. What do you think? Yes.
We sure weren't taught to share our faith.
Okay.
Not in my Lutheran church. Maybe there were some, but I really was not taught.
Okay. Well, maybe there's more of that. It's more widespread than we thought. And it took a while, you know, but with a little child even, to be able to do that and not feel like I was being phony or it was sounding forced or something. But it gradually got over that, you know. There's a couple of books over in the bookstore I want to recommend. I didn't bring copies over, but they're both by John Westerhoff. And two of his books are Raising Our Children in Christian Faith, Bringing Up Our Children in Christian Faith, something like that, and Will Our Children Have Faith? They're both little tiny paperbacks. And I think I found those just about as helpful as anything I ever found anywhere. I think the guy's a Presbyterian minister, and just as sharp as he can be and as helpful as he can be in terms of the whole spectrum from babies on up through teenagers. He offers the advice, for instance, with teens of saying one of the most important things we can do with teenagers in terms of helping them in their spiritual growth is simply admitting that our own struggles, that, hey, we don't have it all together either. you know? And remembering some of the problems and the struggles we went through when we were their age. And saying things like, yeah, I remember what it was like too, you know? There was a time when I wondered if there was a God too, you know? And other struggles that we went through.
Can I say something about Lester Huff before you?
What I recall that was really striking to me about his writings was the fact that, yes, we do need some, you know, preschool, Sunday schools we have up there, some content to the Christian education so that our children know the ins and outs of our tradition. But he says by far the most important and formative influence is not the information that we share with our children, but the environment in which they're raised. And so his argument would be the local church, as well as the family, by who they are and, you know, the worship setting and so on, says volumes to kids. You know, if kids go to a setting where it feels to them, looks to them, and they're pretty sharp, I don't think much gets past most kids, that feels like people are kind of going through the motions, and what they live the rest of the week doesn't really reflect what they see, you know, the people saying in a worship context. You know, kids, it doesn't stack up for them. But if you see a congregation that really is there because they want to be, and there's a lot going on, and they talk about serving others, and in fact that's what they're doing, not only on Sunday, but all through the week, that really forms kids. And that's what he's saying is, you know, it may be about us, I don't know if he goes quite this far, but it might be about as effective for a kid to go along to as several people were talking about hot meal programs and so on, as it might be to sit in a Sunday school box. I mean, mm-hmm. at least to both ends.
Oops.
Oh, sorry.
Who's in charge?
I was just going to say one of the things I think is most important too is that the parents attend church and Sunday school with the kids. That it's not, we send our kids.
Yeah.
I think that's an example that means a lot to the kids.
And I believe there needs to be those connections between Sunday and the rest of the week. Mm-hmm. If it's just something that happens on Sunday, kids can spot hypocrisy a mile away. You know? And if it doesn't have an impact on our values that they see being lived out every day, then so long, Charlie. Mm-hmm. You know, and you got to give them credit for being honest. Yes.
When I mentioned the extended the congregation of the extended family a couple of days ago. They were very formative in my life. Mm-hmm. I saw them as not just part of the congregation, but as very, very close friends of my parents and myself as well, who would nurture me and play with me and teach me as they were playing and all kinds of things that I wasn't aware of then, but of course now I look back and see all this nurturing that's going on.
Yeah. And who lived what they said they believed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
I was just going to back up what you said about the kids and living out what they see in church and in the family and what. I just listened to a series on from James Dobson, and he was talking about compliant children and strong-willed children and the difference in how to raise them and whatever. Mm-hmm. And they had done a survey on, you know, like strong-willed and compliant children as they grew up. They followed this group through. And they did find that even the most strong-willed children, when they went through their teenage years, that wouldn't do anything, almost all of them by the time they got into their mid-20s, had come back to the values and the church if they saw that in the home. You know, that there was only like 5% that didn't.
Yeah, that makes sense.
One of the most helpful things to me was a Christian growth chart. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but it tells in that it's what a child is able to do at a certain age that will help in spiritual growth, the activities that are appropriate for that age level in order to help Christian growth, and it's wonderful.
Okay, well, you might be on the lookout for something like that. Okay, the other area is the area of sexual development. This is one of those topics that in any given group, you're liable to get a whole wide spectrum of of feelings and convictions about this kind of stuff, and opinions about whether it ought to be sex education in the schools and all that stuff, you know, and I don't want to get into that. But what I want to do is use this for an example that I think affects the whole spectrum of parenting, no matter what area you talk about, and that is what we parent our kids with, first of all, is with who we are and the person we have become to this point in our lives. Okay? Parenting is not so much a matter of applying a set of abstract principles, you know, to the rearing of this little beast or this savage, you know, that we've been, that has got to be civilized here, you know, although maybe some of that too. But what we parent with most of all is with who we are. This is one of the best arguments in the world for people not becoming parents until they're old enough. I mean, who's old enough? you know, relatively speaking. We need to become relatively mature, grown-up people ourselves. And of course, one of the things the kids do for us is make us become grown-ups, hopefully. You know, they make us grow up.
And give the child in us somebody to play with.
Right, you know, and hopefully help us to become more in touch with the child in us at the same time. But I'm saying that because I think the most important element, apart from the practical questions and issues that this raises, one of the most important things that we share with our children in terms of their own sexual development and sex education and so forth, or education in human sexuality, is our own feelings about our own sexuality. That's what they get first. No matter what we say, no matter what we verbalize to kids about human sexuality, human sexual behavior, and so forth, what they get more than anything else is our own feelings about it. You know, and if we have a high level of discomfort about our own sexuality and about human sexuality in general, that's what they're going to get, first of all. Now, none of us is perfect. You know, we have all grown up with our own little bundle of hang-ups. You know, and nobody kind of is perfect in this regard and so on. But I think one of the most important skills that we as parents can develop in this area is simply working at the ability to talk about it, to talk about our own feelings about sexuality, and talk about our own convictions and beliefs. You know, one of the worst possible things that can happen to a kid, I believe, is to grow up in a home where nobody ever talks about sex or human sexuality. You know, I mean, let's face it, folks, God made it a part of us and said this is very good, so who are we to say otherwise? Okay? Now, that doesn't mean it isn't also very risky, but I mean, life is risky. You know, that it's just a part of the ball game. So that's the first thing I think we can be aware of and work on, is our own comfort level with our own sexuality and just the whole fact of human sexuality, and our own ability to verbalize that. Even if it just means being able to say to a kid, I'm really not comfortable, you know, talking about this, but I want to, you know, and so let's, you know, since it has come up, you know, and we're hearing all the time on television about AIDS, and, you know, anymore, there is no gap between a child's knowledge of human sexuality and a grown-up's, because we all watch the same stuff on television, you know. And it used to be there was a matter of children didn't, there was things kids didn't know till they got older, and good, bad, or, you know, we might not think it's such a good thing, but the fact of the matter is that that's the way it is. So let's not all pretend it doesn't exist. Okay, that doesn't work either. One of the best ways in the world to have kids who grow up making bad choices about sexual behavior is to never talk about it. Anybody want to argue about that? Or comment?
I don't want to argue about it. I grew up in a home where I had two brothers, and so I learned from my brothers. My parents back then they just didn't talk about it. Yeah. They gave you a book to look at to read, but, you know, So I vowed that when I had children, that I was going to make sure that I, but you really have to swallow a lot to do it, because you just, you know, I wasn't brought up that way, so it's really hard, like you said.
Yeah.
You know, but there's, I teach first grade, and it amazes me how much first grade, and they're very open and honest, you know, in first grade for show and tell, you know? You know, what these kids are allowed to see in the movies that they get to go to. And so, you know, I have an open door where I can, I mean, we discussed this already in first grade, you know, and I'm probably the only one up there turning red. You know, but you have to be open, like you said, because if you're not, then it becomes something dirty.
Yeah.
You know, really, and hush-hush, and it's hard.
And I think our convictions are catching. We have friends who can vouch for this, who their kids are basically raised now, and they say, you know, even when their kids were real little and they would hear about people deciding to live together before they were married. Now, I don't know, this, I don't know, but anyway, their conviction was, this is not a good choice. And they would say so when their kids were 8, 6, 7 years old, you know, and when their kids, by the time their kids were teenagers, their kids were saying, we don't think that's such a good idea. You know, but they talked about it even when their kids were really little. You know, so I had the courage a few months ago when I found out that my wacko sister, who has a 16-year-old son who had become a father, you know, and I'm like, oh, you know, I figured typical, you know, of my sister. But anyway, so I just mentioned it, driving to the, with the kids to school one morning. Do you know what happened? You know, my, you know, your aunt, you know, well, you know, her son who's 16, do you know what he did? You know what, you know? And I did, I didn't get all melodramatic, but I just basically got across the point that I think that's bad, and I think he made a real bad choice, and so did the girl that he got involved with, who was only 15 or something. And I said, there it is. And they all kind of, you could see they were taking it in. You know, but they're only 12, 10, and 8. You know, but it planted the seed.
As long as when you do that, that you make sure that they understand that the person isn't bad.
Right.
It's
Yeah.
I think you need to make sure your children understand that too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that when you get upset with them, with the things that they do and say, it's not that they're bad, it's that the choices that they made were not good choices.
Yeah, that's a great lead into the next thing I want to talk about, and that is, I believe that one of the, from the point of view of a child's spiritual and religious development, as well as from just about any other point of view you can think of with regard to parenting, probably the most important gift parents can give their children is healthy, anybody know what I'm going to write next?
Self-esteem.
Right. Healthy self-esteem. Now that's a great little old word from psychology term, you know, and but it has theological implications. How does it have a theological implication? Where does a child get its feelings, his or her feelings, about God's attitude towards him or her, except through parents and parental attitudes? I am a good person. You know, this basic conviction that I am okay, I'm a good person, I'm valuable, I'm worthwhile, and therefore I have the basic confidence to live life. Sydney Callahan, who is a lady, Sydney Cornelia Callahan, where's her quotation? She says in her book Parenting, which is no longer in print, that the basic goal of all parenting should be to make kids glad they were born and eager for life. That's the ultimate goal we kind of have shining out there in the distance ahead of us, to make our kids glad they were born and eager for life. And realize that we don't have total power over that, but that's, you know, what we need to keep in mind. And making that distinction between the child's behavior and his or her self. You know, if you make a bad choice, in a situation, that doesn't make you a bad person. So that when we say to a child, bad, bad boy, bad girl, when they're really little and they do something that's, you know, obviously unacceptable forms of behavior, whatever it might be, instead of saying bad boy and bad girl, whether it's a teenager or a little child, we can make that distinction in terms of how we respond by saying, you know, bad thing to do, or that was a bad choice to make. What have you learned from that experience, you know? And how, what do you expect us to do with the family car now that it no longer has any fenders, you know? Or whatever it may be. So that's just a basic groundwork kind of thing that, that comes into play in any situation that parents find themselves in. Now, the thing that we have to struggle with here is, I think, that we never do it perfectly. And that's okay. There is no such thing as a perfect parent. Any perfect parents here in this room? You know, we all make mistakes. And yet, if there's anything that we've learned from developmental psychology, it is that human beings are remarkably resilient. And even if we do it wrong, they're going to be able to bounce back more often than not. You know, all it takes is spending a little time with somebody who works with really rotten kids. You know, somebody who works in juvenile court, maybe,
or
something.
No, the kids aren't rotten.
No.
Behaviorists.
Right, well, you know what I mean. Kids who have grown up in situations where it has become almost impossible for them to live a decent life. You know, to give you a little perspective on yourself, and you're really not as rotten a parent as you think you are. You know, so quit groveling in self-pity about how rotten a parent you are. Okay?
Are you familiar with the book by Dorothy Corfield Griggs called Your Child's Self-Esteem? For me, that's just probably the best parenting book out.
Not only is it good for getting information about how to be a parent, but for understanding your own parent, how you were parented.
Right, because if your self, like you were saying earlier, like if your self-esteem isn't in good shape, it's tough.
Yeah.
You know, to then, if I could just, I don't think this is much of a digression, but I can finally watching myself enough to know that when I am really under stress and haven't taken enough time to just be with myself is when I start, all right, pick that up, start doing that, you know, and I just start in on them because there's, it doesn't feel okay in me, and so then I start pointing it out outside me. But when I can take the time to be with me and calm down, then, you know, it's really okay out there. But otherwise, you know, it's just a real radical difference.
Yes.
I think where this self-esteem comes in most valuable, one of the ways it becomes most valuable, is with the drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
If you emphasize to the child you have a wonderful mind, and how easy it is to destroy it. I think that hits home.
Well, and that has come up time and again in books that I've read about the drug issue, you know, that kids who get really seriously involved with drugs are kids with very low self-esteem.
That's it.
They don't really think of themselves as valuable persons. You know, it doesn't mean some kids are going to experiment a little bit or something with something that, you know. But some kids who really go overboard and develop a serious problem, it's a self-esteem problem more often than not. Yeah.
It's also more than likely the kid with the strong will.
Uh-huh.
And that's, we're going through that now. We had a real rough year with our teenager. And self-esteem and all of that. And I think we made it through, but those tapes that I listened to really did show that more than not, because the strong-willed child has the need to be liked more by his peers, and he's more likely to do that, those types of things, even if he knows he shouldn't, because he wants people to like him.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Kind of wind up here.
Right. Just one other point I want to make. Did you want to say something to conclude?
No, I wanted to do the song.
Oh, right. Last point I will make, and that is to make a distinction between self and stuff. We live in a culture that says you are a good parent if you give your baby all the way up through teenagers stuff. You are a good parent if you buy all the latest gadgets, all the latest status symbol toys. What are the latest status symbol toys? Yeah, all that stuff. The ones that they come home saying, everybody else has got one, you know? I'd like to say, oh no, as long as you don't have one, not everybody's got one. So being a good parent is sharing with our kids ourself, which boils down to our time, which means, I don't think, being always right there, you know, here I am, I'm available, you know? That's not the point. I think it's a more general thing called presence. I think kids just need parents present and accounted for as much of the time as possible. So that when something is, when the garter snake is discovered out in the garden or whatever, you're there and the kid can run in with it and say, look! Raggle, 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 raggle. You know? Something as minor as that. Or I learned to whistle, run in and I got somebody to tell about it. You know? That's, I think, what kids need. They don't need stuff. Think of that next Christmas.
You know, I think that with the stuff issue that I see happening, is more mothers going back to work out of the home, that I think out of guilt, maybe I'm wrong, but I think out of guilt, kids seem to be getting more things, you know, instead of the parents, because you don't have the time to do it before and you are giving them more.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But
and we feel guilty.
Kids in the
classroom. Yeah. Toys R Us would go out of business if American parents really believed in this distinction. You know, you can almost see them in there groveling in guilt. Give my kid all this stuff, you know, because I'm, and that's going to somehow substitute.
I think the parents would help the child judge what is good. For instance, they'll say, well, do you think that'll make you a better person? How is this going to help?
Mm-hmm. See, but I don't think kids have that sophisticated at
the
sense of things. They're real hungry.
They don't care if it's junk, but they want it.
Yeah, I agree with the value you're talking about.
But they should be able to answer why they should have it.
Well,
a
I
good
think,
reason for having it.
I think
they
grow
can understand that.
Yeah, I think they grow in that way. That was my
sense. I asked my son about that with Nintendo, you know, because I ever been having a Nintendo. Well, his answer was, it's good hand-eye coordination.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are.
Yeah.
Great. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll get you a set of jacks.
I would like to ask us to do one final kind of exercise or anything. I'd like to do an audiovisual presentation, only you have half the job, because you have the visual part of it. I would like to ask you to close your eyes. This is related to the topic we've talked about today and last time's one. And I'd like you to picture, what I'm going to do is, I hope, sing softly for you a song called This Is Holy Ground by, well, I thought it was by John Michael Talbot. It's sung by him often, but it's written evidently by Christopher Reeve. Anyway, this is Holy Ground. We're standing on holy ground. And what I'd like you to do is picture for yourself your home environment and many of the things that happen at home, the crazy times as well as the delightful times and the holiday times, the various places within your home, the stages as your family has grown. The second verse talks about holy hands. He's given us holy hands. And think about hands washing dishes, changing diapers, taking out the garbage, and so on and so forth. And the final verse talks about these are holy lips. He's given us holy lips. And think about all the ways in which we do the kissing, and we do the speaking, and we do the hollering and the yelling, too. Okay? All of those things. And we'll just close with this as sort of a bit of meditation, if that's okay. So are you ready for your visual part? You have your vision?
This is holy ground. We're standing on holy ground. For the Lord is standing on holy ground. For the Lord is present, and where he is holy. These are holy hands. He's given us holy hands. He works through these hands, and so these hands are holy. These are holy hands. He's given us holy hands. He works through these hands, and so these hands are holy. These are holy lips. He's given us holy lips. He speaks through these lips, and so these lips